Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. Will the poor always be with us, as the Bible quotation suggests? The answer of today's guest, Scott Miller, is not if he can help it. Miller is the CEO and founder of Circles USA. Circles is a nationwide, community-centered, anti-poverty organization based in Albuquerque, which seeks to raise people out of poverty one family at a time. Scott Miller, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Steve.
Scott, later in the show, I want to get to the details of Circles, how it interacts with families in poverty, how effective it has been, and find out about the new Circle that's starting right here in Albuquerque. But first, let's start with why Circles? Why do we need Circles? We've got all these anti-poverty organizations. Why do we need a private foundation trying to get people out of poverty?
Well, we come out of a background of working with people in traditional programs that are out in the communities. And because we did this for so many years, we kept coming up short. All of our programs don't come together to get people out of poverty. So if you look across the country and you walk into a community and you say, okay, so if I wanted to get out of poverty, where would I go to do that? Who would help me do that? It's hard to find an organization organized to do that. We have groups that are organized to get you a job placement. We have groups that can train you for a job. We have groups that can put you into a house or maybe provide some utility assistance or maybe provide food or whatever. But when you ask the question, I know this is going to take maybe a couple of years for me to be able to get where I'm going. Is there some group that can support me through that whole process? It's hard to find that in the charter of a nonprofit or a government organization.
So I guess the simple way of thinking about it was always, well, just get a better job and you'll get out of poverty.
Yeah, you know, if that was just as simple as it was. But the truth is, my background was, I came out of the suburbs. So just to be clear, I didn't have an experience with poverty when I was growing up. It wasn't until I was 18 and I was going to school and I was studying architecture, but I didn't really like architecture.
Really? That sounds fascinating.
I just thought it's not quite me. And a friend had suggested I volunteer at a homeless shelter during one of my school breaks because he just thought that I might find that interesting and give me some ways of thinking about the world differently. So I went down into downtown Rochester, New York, and worked with a homeless shelter and was blown away by the fact that there was all this destitution so close to my suburban life. But I never heard about it or talked about it. It was like a different world altogether. And that had a huge impact on me at 18. So I continued volunteering there for the remainder of my school period. And then when I got out of school, I took a job and was working with families in poverty. And I was amazed that I could see 40 families a week and only be able to give them some financial assistance. And when I wanted to refer them to some other place to solve the problem, I couldn't find it. It wasn't there. They didn't know how to get new jobs. They didn't know how to get connected. The organizations out there, there were so many of them doing some piece of the puzzle of managing poverty that you can spend a lot of time.
There's food, chasing. There's housing, there's unemployment, there's assistance, there's...
And an unintentional consequence of having all that out there in the way that it is right now is that people can spend all their time and energy trying to figure out how to get what I need from the system. It's individual applications, it's individual interviews, different people, different times. It takes a lot. There are lines you wait in. And so if you do enough of that, your thinking can change from how do I get that job and get where I'm going to how do I get what I need out of this system of hoops and things that I need to do to get to the regular...
So you're almost directed towards poverty maintenance instead of getting out of poverty.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that the majority of our resources are spent downstream managing poverty, our community resources.
And making sure people are entitled to get whatever they get. I mean, it seems like so much of what you hear today is... Or is the system being cheated somehow by people?
Well, I think that more to the point is there's a lot of energy spent on making sure people don't get what they're not entitled to. I mean, we want to err on that side of things if we're in these roles, these administrative roles. And so there was some research done that we heard about a couple years ago, done by a number of universities, Georgetown and others, and Northwestern. And they were basically taking a look at what's the cost of poverty. If a kid's raised in poverty, what's the cost to society when they become adults? And the numbers are mind-boggling. I mean, the total tab for the country was $500 billion. New Mexico's official poverty rate is 1% of the nation. So you can extrapolate and say, wow, so we let kids get raised in poverty, and we let a lot of kids get raised in poverty in New Mexico.
Yeah.
But the tab is $5 billion of federal money, state money, local money. There's a cost center in the people coming into jobs and losing these jobs and having to be retrained, and we have to get new people in and all that.
So it would be more cost effective to try to get kids out of poverty than just maintain these families in poverty.
Letting them become adults with a background in poverty is not a great idea. It's very, very expensive.
So I thought that this 1996 welfare reform by Clinton, at least purportedly, I mean, I was a skeptic of it to begin with, to tell you the truth, but it supposedly was going to get people out of poverty because it was going to push them from welfare to work,
stop the
cycle of dependency,
and get
people into jobs, and that was going to be the solution to our poverty problem.
First of all, the intent behind that was to get people off of welfare. If the mindset had been poverty is immoral, it's ridiculously expensive to keep going the way we're doing this, if that was the mindset, we would have had a different program. But the mindset was we all hate welfare, and for all the right reasons, I think. It wasn't long-term encouraging problem-solving, wasn't focused on let's get this problem solved and get people into the mainstream. It wasn't doing that. So, yeah, we all hated it. But the goal to get people off of welfare is a very different goal than getting people out of poverty, because you can get them off of welfare and you can create a lot more problems by doing that that are also going to be expenses in some other cost center. Could be health care, could be prison, could be homelessness, could be mental health issues. All that cost can get shoved off of the welfare ledgers and onto other areas of community supports if you're not careful.
Well, it seemed like initially, you know, after this passed, it looked like it was actually going to be successful. Welfare rolls went down. Poverty rates supposedly went down. And then beginning in 2000, when the economy sort of plunged,
right,
all of a sudden poverty rates have gone up. And actually, it's my sense is that poverty rates are higher now than they've been in a long time.
Forever.
Yeah.
They're the highest now that we've ever, since we're keeping track of this. So, yeah, you could make the assessment, and I think it's a fair assessment to say, the way we've been addressing poverty is not helping us reduce poverty.
So it doesn't seem to be, right?
This overall set of tactics don't work as they're playing out now. I mean, there are elements of it that work. And, of course, I'm not advocating that we throw out lots of stuff that works. There needs to be a safety net. It needs to be approached, though, with a handoff to something long-term. So if you're going to give somebody short-term assistance, at least refer them into a process, if they need it, for long-term support. And when you look at people in poverty and say, can you categorize people in any particular helpful way? You might be able to. You could say there are some people that are in situational poverty. They have lost a job. Someone got sick. Divorce took place. Something happened. And it's typically, you know, mom and a couple kids are now in poverty. And so that's a different approach that you take with somebody who's in situational poverty. They need assistance for a shorter amount of time typically, or they may need to get retrained and back into the work world if they weren't the breadwinner in the earlier configuration of the family. But in the generational poverty group, a group that may have been raised in poverty, there are some rules that are being lived out that aren't copacetic with the middle class schools and jobs that are out there. You've got serious rules about how to live life that come out of having to survive in a situation of poverty. And one of the things that we do with circles is we basically teach what these rules are, these unwritten rules that people are living by, versus what's out there in the general public.
Let me just mention that this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to have on the show today Scott Miller. Scott is the CEO and founder of Circles USA. We're transitioning perfectly to talk about Circles, what its purpose is, how it works, and just go ahead with that, Scott.
So 20-some years ago, when we started really getting serious about getting people out of poverty, not just assisting them along the way here and there, we saw that people were living by a certain set of rules. And if you've been raised in poverty, one of the things it does to people is it puts them in what we call this tyranny of the moment, where you're just trying to manage every day, one day at a time. And it's difficult to get into long-term goal setting, abstract thinking. It's hard to do because you're just...
If you don't have a place to live or a car to get someplace...
That's the thing of the day,
or
you
don't have enough money to do anything, I mean, that's got to be your primary concern.
And so what is it, you know, what do you really need to survive? You need relationships. You have to have people you can count on. You get into a ditch, it's not going to be AAA that you're going to use.
Right.
Could be Uncle Ray, but it's not going to be AAA. I mean, you got to get out of that ditch. And we all know intuitively that we have got to have our ability to survive. And so a set of relationships that are intact is really important if you're in poverty, if you want to survive. And when you're in the middle class, the priority is on getting things done. Because schools, work, it's very task-oriented. It's very much get this job done, get this deliverable, get paid. And that's a different center of gravity. And so we really have to talk about this. We have to say, listen, if you get into a conflict...
So you try to change people's attitude and mind about how they should live their life.
It's both and. I mean, the poverty is caused by two forces, right? Individual behavior and mindsets and decisions and all of that, and the system that we're all living in.
So we work on structural and individual.
You know, people say, is it the system or people? And we say, yeah, it's both. It's all of us. We've created a certain situation here in the United States together. So what we're saying is that these hidden rules need to get out on the table. You need to understand that work is not going to be necessarily tolerant of you trying to solve this crisis with your brother before you come to work, so that's why you're late. And you need backup plans. Your car may break down. Childcare may fall through. You got to think these things through. And these are all the ways in which you could end up losing this job. And there's a value system. There are hidden rules in that job and in that school that we can start talking about so you understand what's important there and why people think the way they think. Then you can be bicultural.
Right? So how do you go about doing that?
Well, one of the things that we do is we give ourselves enough time to do the job. I mean, we're not going to solve people's problems in one visit or even 3 months or 6 months. We have a 10-week class. When the class is finished, they then can be matched with volunteers. And we usually find middle and upper income folks who want to build that relationship with them. That's called a circle.
And those people you call allies, right?
We call them allies, yeah. And once the person's graduated from our initial class, they get to be called a circle leader, which means that they're pulling the strings. So they have two volunteers assigned to them for 18 months.
I love that idea, by the way, that they're called a circle leader, that they're the leader and they're not being directed. They're
right. This is not a prescriptive program. But it basically says you will have a game plan, a written plan, that shows how you're going to get to, let's say, 150 or 200% of the poverty guidelines, which for a family of three is $40,000. You know,
so how would you get there? Of something like that?
I'll give you a real example. We had a woman come in with a child who was 10, and she was working at one of the major retailers and was making part-time wages, no health benefits, and serious health bills and all sorts of problems because there wasn't enough money.
So that's a typical situation.
Had been separated from her husband, and he was out of the picture. So we got her involved with her allies. The allies gave her a lot of booster talks about you have to go out and make full-time wages and health benefits, and you can do it. And she ended up getting her initial job was full-time benefits, full-time work, $12.50 an hour from seven, whatever she was making in the beginning, you know, so a lot more money.
So how did they help her do that? I mean, why couldn't she do that before?
Well, think about how most people get jobs. We have a network, right? If most people listening here lost their job tomorrow, my guess is they're going to be networking to get the next thing.
They're going to call one of their friends and say, what do you know?
You may not run right to the classifieds for your next deal. And it's the same with everybody. So in this particular case, this is how it happened. One of the allies' daughter was the head of the call center and called her up that evening at our meeting and said, can you talk to this woman? And so she put the phone to her and said, talk to my daughter. She runs this place. And she got an interview and she got hired. And now she's got even a better job. So she's moved on from that job. But if people are going to get out of poverty, they typically need a plan, probably a little bit more education and training, and a network. And the network's got to be able to plug them into different kinds of networks, not networks of people that are also struggling with the same issues, but networks that people have jobs and they have connections and they can vouch for people. That's what really makes the big difference.
So one of the things you have are these weekly meetings of these circle leaders with the allies. And I'm just wondering, why do you do that? Why do you have these weekly meetings? Why not just interact just with the allies, for example?
Yeah, the weekly meetings are powerful. Let's just say you're going to try to lose weight. Let's just use that as an example, okay? Because that takes a lot of life changes. To really lose weight and keep it off for, let's say 3 to 5 years, that's going to
take... A lot of people lose it and a lot of people get it back.
Absolutely. And why is that? Because they underestimate what it's going to actually take in terms of the support that they need. There's great research about this that says that if you want to make a big change like this, you better have some things going on. One, you'll probably need a support group of peers that are trying to make the same kind of changes. So we provide that every week. Number two, you're going to need to have people that have, in the case of weight loss, they've already lost weight and they've kept it off. And you need to have access to those kind of people. And in the case of getting out of poverty, you need to be able to access people that are out of poverty and know how to stay out of poverty. You need to have those kind of relationships. And third, you got to stay motivated over a long period of time to make these changes. And four, you have to know how to make the changes. So what we're doing is loading up all of these, if you will, these sources of influence that allow people to make these very specific behavioral changes that will make the most out of their situation. So get a job, keep a job, advance that job. That's the game plan, and get to at least 200% of the poverty guidelines. Have that number in your mind. This is some of the stuff that are the fundamentals of what we do.
So some of these, a lot of these people have demonstrable barriers to succeeding. I mean, they don't have a car. They don't have a safe place to live.
Yeah.
They're in debt. They owe medical bills. They're sick.
Yep.
So
it's all overwhelming.
You're dealing with all that, right?
See, and it's overwhelming. And you want to shove all that stuff into a drawer and just close it, right? I mean, who wants – it's depressing.
So how do you deal with all that stuff?
Well, we just slowly let people bring it out of the drawer and start talking to us about it. And they understand that a little bit of progress is worth celebrating. So a little bit of progress on the debt, a little – our folks come in on average with about $60 in their pocket in cash, period.
And what's amazing, a lot of them are working.
Yeah. Well, if you look at just the national data, it's even more nuts. I mean, we have half the country can't come up with $1,000 right now.
Right.
Half the country. So we're not teaching people about money. I don't know why. It's sort of like living in the ocean. We're all living in the ocean, but everyone forgot to get swimming lessons. And we do the same thing with this money game. We don't teach money well enough. So we have people coming out of school. They're clueless about how much they have to make per month to make it. They also don't know what an asset is. They don't know what a liability is. They just get credit card without thinking about what all that's about. So they get these loans to go to school, and there's no coaching around the loans. And we just see that over and over and over again, and it results in a disaster. So what we're basically saying is that systemically, we've got three major problems. If we want to address poverty, we have to deal with these three major problems. One, we have to teach people money. And two, it's called the cliff effects. But if you've been on public assistance programs, let's just say Medicaid, food stamps, child care assistance, et cetera, and you need that to pull it together, and you're working, at a certain point, you can make only another dollar per hour, and suddenly there goes child care, which could be worth $4 or $5 or $6 an hour, depending on how much you're getting.
So what do you say to people? Don't take the job? I mean,
going to take the job. Uh-huh. They're not going to take the promotion if they can't afford to do that. If they can't figure out how to continue doing child care, they won't do that.
Yeah,
we don't understand.
No economic sense.
Our legislators are not necessarily on top of this. They don't understand the impact of these decisions, of the cliff effects. We blow a lot of money systemically on doing assistance longer than we need to because we haven't smoothed out the ramp off of these programs. So that's second. We have to solve that. These cliff effects have to be solved. And there's been a lot more attention on it over the last few months and years, actually. So maybe that'll get solved. We certainly advocate for that. One of the things we do in circles is called the Big View, and this is a monthly meeting that focuses on things like the cliff effects. And then three, you know, we have got to stop assuming that everyone is, you know, one shoe fits all. We can't build programs that people then try to shoehorn themselves into. We have got to build programs that start where the family's at and what's the package of stuff that's going to get them where they need to get to so that they're in the mainstream and we don't really need to be worrying about what's happening with them in a way that we have to subsidize.
Let me just mention that this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to have on the show today Scott Miller. Scott is the CEO and founder of Circles USA. So that really raises the question, does Circles work, and what is the evidence that Circles works? I mean, how effective really is it?
Yeah, so we've been collecting data for a while now, and we collect data along a bunch of different indicators. But the primary ones are more earned income, more assets, less welfare, and less debt. And in all of those indicators, the numbers are going up. For example, in 2008, the first year we kept our national data, the national income went down by 3% for families. And, you know, and ours went up, I think it was around 38, 39% on average that same year.
You mean the average person who stuck with the program long enough to be through the training, et cetera, their income went up 38%.
Yeah, and now if you stay with Circles for at least 18 months, on average, this is programs that are struggling versus ones that are really going really well. The whole average of that is 88%, an 800% increase in assets. And again, they're not starting with much money, but the fact that they've got enough money for an emergency by the time we're done with the first 18 months is a big deal for these families. They really, really feel the difference of where they're at. And then you, when you look at what are some of the emotional benefits of being involved in a community that wants to help you get out of poverty, you find over and over again people saying, I feel better. I mean, my situation still may be dicey, but I feel more confident about being able to address this. And I know I'm not alone. And one thing that gets across very quickly in circles is that if you are in an emergency, you've got a lot of people that are going to know about it and be available to you. And that, I can't tell you the difference that people report, but being in isolation and poor, that is a bad space to be in. But being in community with people that care about you and that have resources and know-how, and now these things are less intense, and people's depressions lift, they feel better, and they're more able to go out and work.
So this data that you cite, I have to say, before interviewing you, I looked at, I think, three independent views of your organization. They all came out very positively. Mm-hmm. But there's something called the Coalition for Scientific-Based Evidence.
Right.
And what they say is that's just all anecdotal. And what you really should do is do a randomized study. You should put some people who qualify for circles in one group, other people in another group,
right,
follow them and really see how they do.
Well, there's a lot of complexities in what you're saying here. First, so let me just hit a couple of these.
Yeah.
First of all, we are doing a random study through the Department of Labor in North Carolina with young moms that are in circles and young moms that are not. So that study finishes up this year. It'll be interesting to see the difference between the two groups. Secondly, that random control stuff comes out of the medical world. And there's a great article called Expanding the Universe by Elizabeth Shore and Frank Farrell. Frank works with the Casey Foundation. Elizabeth Shore has written a number of books. Her husband, Daniel Shore, you know, friend of
NPR.
So they came out and said there's so many promising practices that are left on the table because of this insistence about these control group studies. And there's not great evidence that, A, they work all that well in the medical community, let alone should be transferred over into the community support social
service
community.
Seems like a lot of drugs have been approved based on these randomized studies that turn out not to – some of them actually hurt you.
And thus my point. So it takes a lot of money to do these random studies. You have to put a lot of money. And if we're so far ahead of public policy, Circles is way ahead of public policy, which means that we have to scrap together what we can get from discretionary funds from United Way, special projects or foundations or whatever. And it's hard to get that kind of big money that would be required to do a control study. So the DOL was the first, Department of Labor, that was the first deal in which the resource was there to do that.
Do you have some figure for cost per participant?
Yeah, it varies pretty wildly. It depends on how much can the community come together to do the volunteer work. It requires two staff people typically, and the tab on two staff people with full-time benefits and all that's going to be 80, 90, 100 depending on the market and per year. And then you've got some program expense. But a lot of places are really creative about getting people repurposed to this work, or they find ways to get all the meals donated, or they find ways to get childcare covered. And so you can be pretty creative. There are very small communities doing Circles on a shoestring and being effective.
But it also seems to me that Circles is almost like a franchise operation. I mean, it's kind of a cookie-cutter thing. You say, this is what works. This is how basically you should establish a circle in your community.
Yeah, we've had consultants come to us and say it would be easier if you were a cookie-cutter situation. But the truth is, one of the unique things about Circles is that it's co-designed to fit the part of the country that it's working in, the people that it's focusing on, and who wants to help. There's a lot of moving parts to Circles because really to help people out of poverty, you have to be very holistic and very long-term in your thinking. And so that creates what they call a complex intervention. And complex interventions are more expensive than easier interventions. You know, it's a lot cheaper to give people food than it is to get them out of poverty. And so when you take a look at what's it really going to take to help end poverty in this country, for example, let me just go all the way up to 30,000 feet for a minute. We have got to support complex interventions that fit families. You got to put the families. It's sort of like if you want to buy a house, the way we do it right now, the metaphor would be, okay, I got 12 people that own this house. There's somebody that owns every room, a different person. I can't reach them all. I'm a broker, but I can't quite reach them all, you know? So I can sell you the bathroom, and I can sell you the downstairs kitchen and maybe the garage, you know, this part of the bedroom. And you're like, what? Who would do this, right? But that is how we're approaching the situation of helping a family out of poverty. There is so much that needs to be pulled together into a coherent plan. We need brokers more than anything.
So that's we're nearing the end of the show, and one of the reasons I wanted to have you on is that even though you're based in Albuquerque,
right,
you haven't, I don't think, had a program here in Albuquerque for a while. But now I understand you are starting one up, and
right,
I just wondered, What's the status of that program, and how can people get involved in it if they're interested in doing so?
Yeah, we're going to be starting a new one. We did one in the South Valley as a pilot to just see what it would take to do things. And it was very co-designed by people in New Mexico for people in New Mexico. And that went well. So now we're going to be doing a new group at the Grace Church in Albuquerque, and it's going to be beginning January 22nd. So if I have my date right, that should be a Wednesday. And if people want to get involved, they just need to go to circlesnewmexico.org. And there will be all the information about what is Circles, what are the volunteer roles, how do I get involved. And we're going to be setting up orientation classes for volunteers starting soon. So all that information will be available. All they have to do is just reach out to circlesofmexico.org.
So one final question. You've been doing this for around 20 years, and I think things are tough now. I mean, there's a higher percentage of people in poverty. Mm-hmm. Money is tight in foundations. Money's in tight with general giving organizations. So I'm just wondering, how do you see the prognosis of Circles? Where do you see Circles going?
Well, the conversation that we're having with national foundations right now is really positive. We've established enough stability in this. We have over 350 different local funders involved with Circles across the country.
That's an astounding figure.
Yeah, and it's quite a dance to keep all that going. So now we've decided we're putting more attention on our national corporations and foundations. And what they're saying to us is that what they like about Circles is that it's extremely accountable. We have a brand new data system that tracks a ton of stuff, gives us enormous ability to give people feedback about how we're doing, compare and contrast communities. And they're saying that what we like about this is that you're going to be in this for probably 18 months to 7 years, depending on what the family is going to need. And you have a way to keep those families engaged. And we don't see that. So the more that I think the National Foundation community, the corporations begin to understand that investing in something like Circles is a real solution for the long haul, it will be easier and easier to be able to scale up Circles as a significant strategy in this country and in New Mexico.
Well, Scott, I'm sorry to say we're out of time. I'd like to thank my guests so much today, Scott Miller, for coming in and talking to us.
Yeah, my pleasure,
Steve.
Thank you.
Studio. Thanks also to my producer, Joe Green. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of this show are downloadable on iTunes under Stephen Spitz. Archives of all my past shows are available at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.